Welcome to Power Play. Hope you're doing well today. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on our program, the CERB is sticking around for the summer.
Even as we start to reopen, a lot of people still need this support to pay their bills while they look for work.
An 8-week extension to the government's key COVID-19 relief program. How will it work and how much could it cost the government? We speak to Workforce Development and Employment Minister Carla Quattro on that and on why Mexico has just halted sending temporary foreign workers to Canada after two died of COVID-19. Then, a major call for top-down change. The Parliamentary Black Caucus, with the support of dozens of MPs and senators, is calling for federal change to break down systemic racism. We'll bring in NDP MP Matthew Green and former Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould. And then fighting for a seat at the UN table.
What's the point of having a seat at the table if you have to sell out Canadian principles to get there?
We demonstrated the kind of leadership on values that Canadians expected, and we will continue to work around the world to defend multilateralism.
Justin Trudeau's campaign to secure a coveted temporary seat on the UN Security Council will end in victory or in defeat. Tomorrow, international relations expert Besma Momani joins our press gallery, not only on the chances, but why this is important and whether Justin Trudeau really did give up too much, as opposition leader Andrew Scheer says in his push for the seat. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. Welcome news for Canadians still struggling to get by as the COVID-19 pandemic just continues. I know there's a lot of COVID fatigue. The virus doesn't care. The Canada Emergency Response Benefit, which is the wildly popular program, will be officially extended by 8 weeks, which means Canadians who are enrolled in the program when it was launched can keep receiving financial aid until the end of the summer. But as the Prime Minister says, it will be a long journey ahead before the economy is back to normal. So could the CERB stay around even longer, and how much will it cost? Let's dig into that and other issues with the Minister of Employment and Workforce Development, Carla Quattro, joins us again. Minister, always good to have you back. You're rapidly becoming a co-host on the program.
Thank you.
Why the extension by 8 weeks?
Well, Evan, we know that as much as we had some positive news in terms of job numbers last month, we're a long way from being out of the woods on this in terms of economic hit and workers who are struggling to find work and won't be able to find work this summer. So we've extended the CERB by 8 weeks, as you said, to 24 weeks. So within the period of March 15th to October 3rd, workers can claim up to 24 weeks of the CERB.
Will the eligibility requirements change? For example, the president and CEO of the Canadian Federation of Small Businesses, Dan Kelly, says, why don't you just make sure that, you know, if you earn more than $1,000 a month, which you're allowed to do, but $1 over and you can't collect the $2,000 a month from the CERB, will that criteria change and you'll let people maybe earn a little more to allow them to get back into the workforce without having to sacrifice the CERB support?
Well, that's not changing for now, Evan. So what we've decided is we'll keep the benefit level at $500 and the allowable earnings at $1,000. In an ideal world, we would indeed have a more working well on claim-like system like we do in EI, where people can, you know, gradually earn up to a certain amount and money is taken kind of at $1 to $2 at a time. But the reality is our system doesn't have that capacity. We had to set a threshold. We determined a while back it was $1,000, and we continue to believe that's the best level of allowable earnings for people on this benefit.
There are some questions that if you want, I mean, I understand the beginning, the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, it was popular, it got the money out the door, and 8.4 million Canadians are using it. I appreciate that right now. But the feature of it was to keep people out of work. Now you're trying to get people back at work. Why not transfer people off the CERB onto EI if they can't get work? That would allow the system to end, but you put people on the EI system?
Well, that's a really important question. And acknowledging the fact that CERB wasn't actually built to transition people back to work is super important. But the reality is that a significant number of people who are getting the CERB aren't eligible for EI. So if we just flat out transition people to EI tomorrow or 1st of July, too many people right now would be left behind who don't have work or who aren't working for childcare reasons or sickness reasons. Eventually, absolutely, people who are EI eligible will be transitioned back to that system. And we're going to have to take a look at how we continue to support people who aren't EI eligible. But we determined that right now wasn't that time to do it.
Okay, so now this is an 8-week extension. Is the government open to more extending? Maybe, you know, there could be a second wave. This could go longer.
Well, I think you've asked two different questions there. So right now, the SIR, we are not intending to extend it beyond this additional 8-week period. If at some point in the future, say the fall or early next year, there was a second wave, of course, we'd have to look at what support for Canadian workers would look like at that time. Hopefully, lesson learned from SIRB. Hopefully, we've transitioned people back into an EI system that's more capable of sophisticatedly addressing work realities at that time. But right now, the plan is 8 weeks, and that's it.
Okay, so I just want people to know, this is it. The government's saying 8 weeks for now, that's it. Then let's talk about the cost. You were on this program last week saying it's $17 billion a month. I spoke to the parliamentary budget officer. He said that must be at the peak. How did you get that number, and what do you think, what is the estimate for the next 8 weeks of costs?
Well, really, thank you for allowing me to share the math. So as of June 4th, it was a $44 billion cost to the SERB. So that's half of March. All of April, all of May, it was $44 billion. The most expensive month was $17 billion. That's where I got my $17 billion figure. At the very most, with 8 million people on the SERB, which we actually don't expect 8 million people to stay on the SERB, it's a $17 billion price ticket a month. The reality is, already 1.2 million Canadians are off the SERB that were on it a month ago. The reality is we now have 2.6 million Canadians on the wage subsidy. We're right now determining how many of those were from SERB. So it's not going to cost that much, but it's better to have a maximum than to underestimate cost.
Nearly 8.5 million applications for SERB were approved, 453,000 for the wage subsidy. I keep asking the question, is the wage subsidy, I don't know, what is going wrong with that? You thought you guys clearly underestimated SERB and overestimated the wage subsidy.
Well, I'm not sure it's quite, I wouldn't put it that way, but I understand what you're getting at. We haven't had the uptake on the wage subsidy as that we had expected. We're looking at why that is. As I said, we have employers who just don't know how many people they want to hire back, whether it's at a 75% subsidy or not. We've got people who are earning up to $1,000 on the SERB, so we've got more part-time workers. There's a number of explanations. We also have changes to the wage subsidy, the effects of which we probably won't see for a couple more weeks. So it's still, we're still trying to figure that out. You're not wrong, and we're working on it.
Okay, two things. Mexico stopping sending temporary foreign workers over COVID-19 infections. This is a big issue. People underestimate how important temporary foreign workers are to much of our labor force, certainly in agriculture, and yet the conditions they work under are pretty brutal. What will that change, and what protections will these workers have?
Well, first of all, of course, our condolences to the families of the temporary foreign workers from Mexico who lost their life to COVID. It's a tragedy. We feel just awful that this has happened when they've come here to help us. To your point, this is about food security for Canadians. This is about making sure Canadians have food on their tables, and we have a lot of people from around the world helping us make sure that happens. The reality is this is yet another crisis that has been brought to the forefront in terms of how people are treated, the working conditions. We've really worked hard, having said that, since the beginning. I've been working with the Mexican ambassador, as has my colleague, from the beginning when we put in place quarantine measures for temporary foreign workers. Mexico was confident in those measures. And quite frankly, those measures protected workers, and we didn't have any outbreaks during the quarantine period. What's now happened as workers have started working, they've gone out into our communities, and they've gotten sick. And so we need to figure out, is it their working conditions, their living conditions, pay level? What are the things? And as I've said a couple of times today now, you know, starting next week, we need to increase our investigations. We need to get public health officials into these farms where there are outbreaks. We need to make sure workers have the information, that they know that they can access SERB, that they have options and choices, because this really is unacceptable.
All right, we're going to talk about this later, but do you support Metro, Loblaw, and Sobeys all pulled their pandemic pay of $2 extra an hour? They're making record profits, executive bonuses, and they pulled that Do you support, do you want them to stand before this parliamentary committee and answer why they're pulling the pandemic pay? And are you concerned that they all just happen to do it on the same day?
Well, first of all, I would encourage businesses to continue to pay workers. We're not at all through this crisis. We're still clearly in a pandemic. You know, my preference would, of course, personally have been for them to keep the pay at what it was. But they need to make their choices and they need to be held accountable for them.
All right, I got to leave it there. Minister Qualtrough, always good to have you on the program. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
And by the way, speaking of accountable, we'll talk to a Liberal MP who wants to pull them before a parliamentary committee. But before a break, the news you need to know today. Canada's Air Force is sending the CH-148 Cyclone helicopters back into the sky. Remember, that fleet was grounded since a fatal crash back in April that killed six Canadian service members. The military gave an update on the investigation into the crash today. Check out what they had to say.
The crew would have had no previous experience nor exposure prior to this event on how to handle the situation. The accident was unavoidable based on their low altitude and consequently the lack of time they had to realize that the aircraft was not responding to their inputs.
Colonel Alexander says now that they understand what happened to the chopper, the investigation will shift focus to understanding why. Meanwhile, south of the border, U.S. President Donald Trump has signed an executive order on police reform. He signed it after meeting with families who have lost loved ones in deadly encounters with police. Check this out.
Reducing crime and raising standards are not opposite goals. They are not mutually exclusive. They work together. They all work together. That is why today I'm signing an executive order encouraging police departments nationwide to adopt the highest professional standards to serve their communities.
Trump says the order will aim to establish higher standards for policing, ban chokeholds by police, unless the officer's life is in danger. Also, a dramatic increase in tensions on the Korean Peninsula today. You got to know this. After North Korea blew up an empty liaison office used for talks between North and South Korea. Look at this.
북남 공동연락사무소가 완전 파괴됐습니다.
North Korea state media announced the destruction of the building near the heavily armed border between the two nations. South Korea's defense ministry says it will respond, quote, strongly to any military provocations. Watch that space. And here's another one to watch. Indian officials say at least 20 Indian soldiers are dead after a violent clash with Chinese forces in the Himalayas. Now, the deaths occurred in the region of Ladakh, where India and China share a disputed border. The incident marks the most serious conflict between the neighboring countries in decades, since the 40s, actually. China's Foreign Affairs Ministry claims the soldiers illegally crossed the border twice. Senior military officers from both countries are now meeting to defuse, or at least to try, to de-escalate an incredibly dangerous situation. Coming up, a group of black lawmakers are calling on the government to take action on systemic racism. Will it actually lead to change? Will they end mandatory minimums? Member of the Parliamentary Black Caucus, Matthew Green, joins us, and then we'll be joined by the former Justice Minister, Jody Wilson-Raybould. Stay with us.
I think it's really important that we all come forward and look at bold ideas that we can take on very soon to fix the systemic discrimination that continues to exist in our country.
Canada is a great country, but for many black Canadians, it has yet to achieve its full potential. That stark truth comes from a statement made by the Parliamentary Black Caucus calling on all levels of government to dismantle systemic racism in this country. Among the calls to action are justice reforms, changes to policing, diversifying the public service, and specifically to follow through on a promise Justin Trudeau made when he was first elected in 2015 to end mandatory minimum sentences. Will that happen? To discuss all that, Matthew Green, an NDP MP and a member of the Parliamentary Black Caucus, is here. And we've also have the former Justice Minister and independent MP, Jody Wilson-Raybould. First of all, good to see both of you, and I hope you and your loved ones are well. I'll start with you, Mr. Green. Calls to tackle systemic racism, obviously They're long overdue, echoing across the world and this country in the wake of the George Floyd situation, tragedy. What specifically would you and the caucus like to see change here in Canada?
Well, I think what we're hearing is a real conversation on the framing of public safety and what that means for communities. Exactly who are we keeping safe? You only have to look. You don't have to go to the South. You can look right here to instances of horrific and violent brutality against both Black and Indigenous communities here. We are echoing the calls of the Black Lives Matter movement, which looks at defunding and reprioritizing investments into the social determinants of health. We know that police budgets continue to balloon across the country, while simultaneously the quality of life for people is certainly not being improved.
It is remarkable, as many commentators have pointed out, never calls to decrease funding for police, but often decreasing funding for other things like healthcare and education. An end to mandatory minimum sentences has been a big part of the call. I'm going to go to Jody Wilson-Raybould on that. The Prime Minister said today that's not off the table, but Jody Wilson-Raybould, you had already advocated for that when you were the Justice Minister and it didn't happen. Why is that so important to happen, and what has delayed that?
Well, I mean, depends on who you ask what the answers would be in terms of why the delay. But I mean, I 100% support Matthew Green and the Black Parliamentary Caucus and all the allies that signed on in terms of what needs to be done for justice policing, specifically with respect to mandatory minimum penalties. It has been proven time and again, expert panel reports, discussions among attorneys general, that mandatory minimum penalties are a direct cause of the overrepresentation of Indigenous peoples and other marginalized Canadians in the criminal justice system. They do not enable judges to exercise the necessary discretion that they should be able to when sentencing individuals that come before them. It was a promise of this government in 2015, and it is something that I asked about yesterday in the parliamentary committee. It's something that needs to happen, and repealing mandatory minimum penalties is something that I will continue to press for.
Okay, I'm going to come back to that, but I'm going to bring back Mr. Green for a second, because there's a number of other items in this statement. One of them is police reform. At a federal level, what needs to happen there?
Well, we've called time and time again for the automatic and immediate banning of the use of carding or street checks or racial profiling for all federal institutions that we have oversight over. And we're also extending that call to municipal levels of government. Of course, that's something that can happen right now. If you look at our ability to provide transparency, we have called for the release of all incidents of use of force. There appears to be an ongoing racial amnesia in this country, where every time an incident of police brutality against Indigenous or Black people, we have to start the conversation with, does racism exist? We know that it exists. Right. We want to see it quantified. And we also want to have a release of all of the costs for the civil settlements that are coming out of police misconduct.
And that, by the way, that's absolutely a profound point. Why we have to start on first base every time these events happen is a mystery to many people. Jody Wilson-Raybould, in Nunavut, the Court of Appeal actually ruled to uphold mandatory minimums, citing protections for Indigenous women. A lot of people don't get that. Are mandatory minimums beneficial in some scenarios? Oh, we've lost Jody. I'm going to come back to Jody Wilson-Raybould on that.
May I add just an aspect to the?
Matthew Green, go ahead. We'll reestablish with Jody, but go ahead, Matthew.
Because that has caused some consternation in terms of who, you know, ought to be provided the ability for de-incarceration. It's one of our calls. I'd like to put particular focus on cannabis amnesty. If you look at a time during legalization when the major corporations, the major Bay Street blue chip stocks that are out there, these are populated by people, former law enforcement, former Hill staffers, politicos, people with partisan ties, while simultaneously Black and Indigenous populations remain incarcerated for nonviolent cannabis offenses. And of course, there's an ongoing conversation around decriminalizing drugs and recognizing that the war on drugs is a failed war. And so we've locked people up. We have criminalized mental health. We have criminalized addictions. Of course, these are not just unique the Black Indigenous populations, but they have a profound and disproportionate impact on the sentencing, on the length of sentencing, And of course, the fact that we still have people in jail to this day on cannabis, nonviolent cannabis offenses, I think is highly hypocritical when we see the types of people who are involved in the profiteering off of cannabis.
I think we got Jody back, Mr. Green, just hanging
Sorry,
on. Sorry. Jody Wilson-Raybould, I don't know if you heard the question, but the Nunavut Court of Appeal ruled to uphold mandatory minimums. They say they protect Indigenous women. A lot of people are worried about that. Are mandatory minimums, are they beneficial in some scenarios?
Well, I mean, as a general principle, I believe fundamentally that judges need to have the discretion to approach, to look at sentencing based on the individual that is before them. There are different circumstances. Mandatory minimum penalties have been discussed for a long time. As I said, the Supreme Court of Canada has weighed in and rendered many mandatory minimum penalties unconstitutional. I think the point and what is of prime importance is to ensure that we enable judges to exercise the necessary discretion and take into account the circumstances of the convicted person before them, whether or not they have mental health and addictions issues, whether they come from an Indigenous background and are suffering from you know, the ongoing legacy of the colonial reality. There's many circumstances that lead individuals into the criminal justice system, and our system needs to reform to be not just hard on crime. I think we need to be, as President Obama has said and many others, we need to be smart on crime and, you know, engage in really good public policy discussions and be open to Canadians about why we're making decisions and why mandatory minimum penalties need to be repealed.
Right. And just just so people know, we do have something in the GLADU report and the GLADU principle and law that does take into that account. For now, the question is, does that get expanded?
I should state that is one of our points to invest in the restorative justice programs and community grounded initiatives. We know that to be true. We have seen the ability for pre-sentencing reports, for adjustments on sentencing based on GLADU. And part of our recommendations is to look at how that could be applied to Black, Brown, and other racialized Canadians who are overrepresented. The other aspect that we're calling for is to provide supplementary legal aid for individuals, because this is also a question about who can afford the access to representation.
I would just add on.
Go ahead, real quick, Jody.
Just add on to what Matthew was saying. I mean, we actually need to ensure as Canadians that we make the case to the governments to invest the necessary dollars and think beyond election periods and do what is right that will show and reap rewards down the line as we take care of the most vulnerable among us.
Absolutely.
Jody Wilson-Raybould and Mr. Green, great to have both of you. These are absolutely critical discussions. I'm glad we're having them. Thanks to both of you. Coming
up
next, the Liberal motion looks to take grocery chain execs to task for terminating wage increases for frontline workers. The MP behind the move, this is going to be fascinating. He joins us next. Stay with us. So grocery store execs may soon get a grilling from parliamentarians for suddenly cutting pandemic pay increases for frontline employees. Remember, they gave them a $2 increase and now, poof, it's gone. Liberal MP Nathaniel Erskine-Smith is calling on a House committee to put representatives from Loblaw, Metro and Sobeys, companies who've seen profits surge amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, in the hot seat for canceling the wage boost for grocery store workers, or heroes as they were once called. How is it also that all three major grocery chains all just happened to cancel the $2 hour pandemic pay raise on the same day? Let's find out. Nathaniel Erskine-Smith joins us now. Sir, good to have you on the program. Why do you want these execs to be questioned? What do you want to ask them?
Well, two things fundamentally. First, we're in the middle of a pandemic. The modest pay increase reasonably of $2 was made in the course of this pandemic. And I think this pandemic's given a lot of us pause to reconsider whether we are compensating essential workers in our society enough. And I'd like to know why the pay was canceled in the middle of a pandemic. And two, and principally to the point of the industry committee, our committee is responsible for the competition laws of Canada. When we see these three major chains all cancel this pay on the same day at the same time, I'd like to know if there was cooperation among them, if there was collaboration among them, and if there was collusion among them.
And we've seen among some chains before around the price of bread. Remember the price fixing on bread and the collusion there. Are you concerned about that in this case as well?
There obviously has been history of collusion. You mentioned the bread example. And in the end, we don't have enough information. This is exactly why I'd like to hear from senior executives from every single one of these companies. But I think it's our responsibility as parliamentarians on this committee to ensure that there isn't collusion in reducing wages of our essential workers in the middle of a pandemic.
This is a private sector, though. What business is it of the government, whether a public company or a private company, is setting their own wages for workers? Isn't it up to them to do that?
Well, so if I was at the provincial level, I'd say it's absolutely the responsibility of governments to look at minimum wages. We, at the federal level, though, have the Prime Minister said today that we want to make sure essential workers are being paid what they deserve and the minimum wage isn't enough. And we've, as a federal government, entered into collaboration and partnership with provinces to increase the pay of essential workers. And whether it's a long-term care home, a nursing home, or a grocery store, I do think as a society, we ought to be reconsidering what essential work is and whether we're compensating essential workers, frontline workers, enough. But competition laws are squarely within federal jurisdiction, squarely within the jurisdiction of our committee. And it doesn't matter if you are a private company, you are answerable to the competition laws of our country.
How much have these companies made? Has the COVID crisis been profitable for them?
So we have seen record profits from all three of these chains, double-digit percentages, over 20, over 30% increases in profits for these companies in the course of the pandemic. And so the idea that they would say, here's your $2 wage increase, essential workers, and oh, by the way, it's going to last for a short period of time, and we're, as executives, going to enjoy our profits, is it's really frustrating to see. And I've certainly heard from, in the course of, you know, I just introduced the motion yesterday. It's going to proceed to a vote on Thursday, and I expected to have support from my colleagues. But already, I've received a lot of correspondence from grocery store frontline workers to say this hearing absolutely needs to happen. It's unacceptable.
Okay, just last question, sir. The economy is reopening, though, right? And I get it. There's still real concerns about the virus, but a lot of workers are going back to work. Are you suggesting this wage increase be permanent?
As I say, I think we should have a serious conversation as a society about how we pay essential workers. And we've seen at the worst of this crisis, we saw our frontline grocery store workers, our frontline healthcare professionals, and those in nursing homes go into very dangerous working conditions in many instances. And these are, in some cases, the lowest paid members of our society. And I think we do have to rethink that. We've seen Galen Weston say, I would love to see governments move in and increase the minimum wage, and we should have a more progressive minimum wage. We've seen the same thing from other significantly wealthy individuals in our society. They can act on their own. They don't need governments to act. And ultimately, I would say provinces should increase the minimum wage, and we should pay essential workers what they deserve.
Yeah, again, record profits during the crisis. They just pulled back the pandemic pay of $2. Sir, great to have you on the program. Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, are we in? Or are we out? The Liberals' campaign to nab a seat on the UN Security Council is coming to an end. Vote is tomorrow. Will Canada win, and why is it important? The Press Gallery is standing by to discuss. Stay with us.
He has apologized for the Iranian regime when they shot down a plane full of Canadian citizens, and he refuses to list the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist entity. So, what's the point of having a seat at the table if you have to sell out Canadian principles to get there?
The Conservatives have kept with the Harper approach to international diplomacy. The failed
standing
presence of Canada on the world stage was an embarrassment for many Canadians
terror.
For many, many years.
What is the point of a seat on the Security Council? Will the Prime Minister's years-long global lobbying effort to snag a temporary seat on the UN Security Council finally pay off? And why is it important? We'll find out as 193 ambassadors place their votes tomorrow for the non-permanent seats. We're competing against Norway and Ireland. How will Canada fare in that competition? The Press Gallery is going to break it all down. CTV Ottawa Bureau Chief Joyce Napier is here. CTV's Molly Thomas is here. She knows that place well. And joining us, our special guest, Besma Momani, a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Waterloo. Great to have all of you here. And Besma, let me start with you. I'm sort of Yogi Berra. The one thing I don't predict is the future, but are we going to get it? And why is it important, I think, is the more profound question.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be an uphill battle for sure. It's not going to be easy. Our competition, both Norway and Ireland, have been outspending us. They've been at this for some time. We're late to the game in many ways, although we've got some inertia of a goodwill. So, but it's not easy. Let's be frank about that. Why it matters, I mean, look, there's prestige. There's perhaps a lot of pride in this, particularly for us Canadians who feel like we're a country that is so internationalized in many ways, and we should be there, and we've done some good things. But look, I think in terms of why we want it, I think there's going to be some indirect benefit to us in terms of business, in terms of attracting talented immigrants to this country. There's lots to win, for sure. There's an upside, but it's definitely not going to be an easy win for us if we get it.
Molly, you know the UN pretty well. What do you make of, why is it important? A lot of people say, well, there's no point in this. The UN is a dysfunctional organization at best. You're winning a lottery prize no one wants to win.
It's an influence card, I think. It gives you a space at the table that other countries in the world are looking up to you, and they can bring their concerns and problems to you as well. And you are a voice for a lot of them at the table. I think that's a huge, huge point of view. For Canada, I mean, it pays off for us that we're part of the G7 and we have all of those ears around the table listening to us. Of course, our historic ties with the U.S., not that it's paying off that well right now, but, you know, there's also an election in the fall. And the fact that, We're known for our diversity. Besma pointed that out, right? The diversity in our country represents the world. So those are the positives. But on the negative side, I mean, I think small countries, developing countries on the world I've been to and lived in and worked in, have cared about money in the bank and boots on the ground when it comes to peacekeeping. And Canada is behind Ireland and Norway in both of that per capita of our GDP. And so I think that is going to matter for a lot of people voting tomorrow.
Joyce, what do you make of Andrew Scheer's criticism that Canada sold itself short on the world stage in order to buy this seat? Any substance to that?
Well, I don't know if that's perfectly accurate. I mean, Andrew Scheer can go ahead and say that, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. So Canada's already in the G7, the G20, the Organization of American States, APEC, Commonwealth, Francophonie. So, you know, in terms of having a voice on the international stage, I think we already have a voice. And is it a big voice? Probably not. I would say it's a medium voice that Canada has. And, you know, the Prime Minister has been lobbying. If you follow the phone calls that he's had every day, practically in the last few months, it has been with African leaders, with Latin American leaders. So obviously a big push. Our foreign affairs minister has been in New York since Saturday lobbying and making sure that actually these ambassadors, these 193 ambassadors, go to vote. So it's an election like in any country. You know, you're pushing people to go and vote because, you know, it's COVID, it's complicated, it's going to be a much longer vote. And I do think that ultimately it's a legacy thing and it's a pride thing. Is it going to give Canada a bigger voice? Probably. But what will Canada do with that big voice? And does really Canada right now need that bigger voice is the question.
Besma, you know, some argue, look, despite the fact that there's legitimate criticisms of the United Nations or the obstructive behavior of China and Russia and the Permanent Council, this is really the last bastion of small L liberalism, the kind of 75 years of trade and enforcement of rule of law. So countries like China, for example, don't kidnap Canadians when they don't like the law. That this is the way to enforce international norms and Canada should be at the table. What do you make of that argument, and what's the case against Canada to do that?
Yeah, look, you know, Canada is, as a middle power, you know, we need multilaterals and we need international fora like the United Nations. This is where we thrive because, frankly, you know, we also live beside the great elephant, as you know, the Pierre Elliott Trudeau said, and that's really important for us to be able to come with this group consensus and to say, look, we stand behind so many others in our common cause. Of course, this is the exact opposite of in terms of time and mood. We see the world moving the opposite way. And it's not just China and it's not just Russia. It's the United States. It's even some of the countries in Europe that we had looked at, like Poland and Hungary, as places where they were going to be, you know, embracing democracy. They're moving the other way in terms of liberalism. So it feels like, indeed, like really, we belong not just at the seat of the Security Council because that's the right place for us and all that we represent. But at the same time, we need to be there because there are these naysayers out there that are more introverted, that are, frankly, more aggressive and don't really embody the liberalist values of what the UN really is all about. So, yes, I couldn't agree more that this is feels like it's our time, but it's not going to be easy because we've been outspent. We have been out-campaigned. And at the end of the day, that's really what matters.
And Norway and Ireland may try to advocate for the same things anyway. Let me just quickly switch gears. Molly, the Canadian-U.S. border restrictions are extended for another 30 days. We're hearing reports of Americans saying, hey, I'm going to come tour Banff, but I'm only here because I'm headed to Alaska. How do you square that circle?
Yeah, that's going to be a problem for Canadians that have put off their trips and their travels and seeing a lot of their family down south. Listen, that's not going to work out for people. I think most Canadians understand. They're looking at the cases in the U.S. over, 100,000 deaths. Nobody wants to open that border right now. Everyone I've talked to in circles around the country, different provinces have said, keep those borders closed as long as possible. Keep Canadians safe. And so I think if there's people coming in for other reasons, they're not going to be happy about that at all.
Joyce, if you report long enough, you'll see it all. Now people want the U.S. border closed. Man, I never thought I'd live to see the day. But it doesn't look like it's going to open soon.
No, and this was a Canadian ask, by the way. We know that, but they did not, sort of want to poke the bear on the other side. So they had to do it very diplomatically. In other words, dealing with Homeland Security, border services, more than with the White House, of course, who's busy with many, many other huge issues. But, this was something, Canada wanted. We saw the Nanos poll, what was it, last week, that said, so many Canadians, 7 out of 10, wanted that border closed. And in fact, some of them want it closed till the end of the year, Evan. So, it's not a big surprise that on the Canadian side, and probably a sigh of relief. And we heard the mayors, for instance, of Windsor saying that, look, we love going to the other side. It used to be one big city but now we want it closed, let's leave it closed for another month. Because Canadians, as Molly says, feel safer. I mean, look, the curb is different here than in the United States. And we've all been, locked up for 3 months. And we don't want to throw it to the wind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's pretty astonishing. Guys, I got to take a short break. Besma, great to have you back on the program. We'll definitely have you back very soon because there's lots to discuss, especially as that key vote for the UN comes up tomorrow. But coming up next, 8 more weeks of CERB, says the Prime Minister. What about the cost? And on the eve of the first Conservative leadership debate, that's Thursday. Remember that race? Where do the contenders rank? Press galleries next. Lisa Raitt will join us as our special guest. Stay with us.
The Prime Minister is still using talking points from April. It's now June, and he's refused to fix these programs, and he's successfully talked out the calendar on the days that the House of Commons could meet to discuss these programs. So when will he make these changes to get more help to Canadians who need it?
Nick, we have constantly been updating and expanding our various programs. We recognize in conversations with the premiers how important it is to make sure that we're working together, provinces and federal government.
So everybody's favorite COVID-19 aid program, the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, is getting a second wind for the summer. Ottawa is extending the CERB program by 8 weeks. So for anyone who applied for that program when it was originally rolled out, you'll now be getting $2,000 monthly payments until the end of August. But what about the price? Can Canada afford to roll out CERB for another 2 months? Could be $34 million or billion dollars should the program be changed to reflect the recent provincial reopenings and people going back to work. The press gallery is back to discuss that and the upcoming Conservative leadership debates. CTV Ottawa Bureau Chief Joyce Napier is back. So is CTV's Molly Thomas and CTV News political analyst and former MP and Minister Lisa Raitt joins us. Now, Lisa, great to have you join the program today. Let's just start on CERB. Unbelievably popular. It's extended. Right decision, Lisa, even though it's incredibly expensive?
I don't think any government official anticipated that the lockdowns would go this long or that the economy would be on ice this long. So therefore, their first guesstimate at how many weeks they were going to need CERB for it, they have proven to be incorrect. So now they have to roll it out for a further 8 weeks. But you're right. This is a huge cost. And they better start thinking about what the alternative is, because I don't think extending past August 30th again is going to work.
Joyce, Carla Quarter, the Minister of Employment, was on here saying, we are not extending it. It's, unless there's a second wave, this is it. But man, there's 7.5 at least million people still using it, and it's unbelievably popular. So they got to figure something out. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, you ask if we can afford it. I think the question has to be, can we afford not to do it? You know, if 7 million Canadians out of a workforce of 19 million Canadians, right, are on CERB, how can you just pull the rug from under all these people? The economy is reopening, but we know just by looking in our own neighborhoods, maybe that restaurant is reopening, but it's only the patio. So they don't need the 10 waiters or the 15 waiters. This, you know, multiply this across the country. So yes, the economy is restarting, but that doesn't mean that all those people who were put on the CERB or who were laid off or fired or whatever and lost their jobs are back and working again. So I don't know what's going to happen in 8 weeks, but, you know, that could be a great Canadian tragedy if indeed, you know, these 7 million people or 7.5 million people who are still on CERB don't find a job.
Yeah, and Molly, the CERB is wildly successful, certainly in this context. I'm not sure if they're going to transfer people onto EI if they qualify, but some are saying CERB could be a precursor to a universal basic income. What do you make of the thoughts of how to transition from the current formula?
Well, I think they were hoping that that emergency wage subsidy would be the thing that would wean people off of CERB onto it. Obviously, right. There hasn't been the uptick that the government had hoped for there, right? And so now you have to figure out a way to help these Canadians. This at least gives them an 8-week lifeline for the 3 million Canadians that we know from statistics that are looking for jobs and can't find them. The one thing that I find interesting, you know, some people have said, you know, this is a financial crutch. Well, I think it's you got to look at the people and the people. You know, if they're refusing to go back to work, that's one issue. And I think maybe CERB needs to be catered around that to make sure that people aren't refusing jobs. But at the same time, you have to consider mental health, anxiety issues. If people don't feel safe to go back to work, I think that's a whole nother component that we have to consider in this as well and who might be eligible for CERB.
Hugely important. All right, let me flip over to the leadership race for the Conservatives. Lisa, tomorrow is the French language debate. Then there's the English language debate, which we'll have a special on. What are we expecting to see? And should we be nail-biting ourselves about hearing some of these candidates speak French for that long?
Well, it's the first debate is entirely in French. I'm not moderating the first one. My colleague Dan Nolan is, and he'll be taking the reins. What's interesting and what is noted yet is that we had over 1,000 submissions via video link through our conservative.ca website proposing questions. And those questions have been winnowed down to the 10 that you're going to see on tomorrow night, the 10 you're going to see on Thursday. There are questions coming in from Canadians and Conservatives across the country, and it's going to be really interesting. And the format is different too, Evan. It's not going to be like the 14 of us talking heads across the stage. We're going to have one-on-one. So the first six questions are going to be each candidate facing off against their counterpart.
En français maintenant pour Joyce. Joyce, what do you expect from the French language? Because that's a big issue, because if Conservatives want a shot, they got to be fluent because you need Quebec.
Okay. I don't want to be mean. So I'll say that I will be listening to that debate. But, you know, I think it's important. I think it's important for them. You're right. They've got to be heard in Quebec. But, you know, the party's in a funk, definitely in a funk. I mean, we have all been following politics for long enough to know when a party is in that position. And I mean, it was overshadowed, or should I say maybe obliterated by COVID-19, this race. So we're not really talking about it. Maybe there's some interest in some circles. Obviously, Lisa just said they got a whole bunch of people interested in asking these candidates questions. And so are we. But for the last week, we've been trying to talk to them, and none of them have wanted to speak to the media because they are preparing for the debate. I suspect it's the French debate, but candidates, just a little friendly note, you can't learn French in 1 week.
Yeah, and that's going to be important. Molly, the other thing is the voting system, and I'm going to be watching for this. Obviously, French is going to be important. But the down ballot, some polling suggests Erin O'Toole sees himself as people's second choice from the two social conservatives that are also part of this four-person race. And then the CBC obtained a leaked video that said, yeah, he'd like to be the second choice for social conservatives. And he's even talking a bit about things like conversion therapy. What do you make? Are you watching for that, how they're trying to calibrate to a certain constituency?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, how they express themselves in French around those issues, too, which are very progressive parts of our country that are very concerned about those issues. So it'll be very close to check. I mean, Evan, one interesting thing about the French conversation, there's a few of the leadership candidates that we have spoken to in the House in our French, or our colleagues have asked a few basic questions in French, and they weren't able to answer at times. So everyone will be watching. I wonder if the French debate will actually, the language around it, will take up most of the conversation before we even get to the English debate on Thursday.
All right, Lisa, I got about 20 seconds. Anything you're particularly watching for in terms of how they're setting it up?
Well, I know what the setup is going to be. And I think what's being attempted this time is that Canadians are going to see these candidates in action. They're going to see them debating one another. They're going to see them basically facing off against one another, which is what we need coming into the next election.
All right, Lisa Raitt, great to have you on the program. We'll be watching those debates tomorrow night and the next night. Molly and Joyce will be glued to the TV, and I hope you are too. We'll have special coverage of the Conservative Party's English language leadership debate on Thursday beginning at 7 p.m. Eastern right here on CTV News Channel. I'm looking forward to be part of that coverage, and I hope you join us then. And that is your Power Play Day in Politics. What a day. As it always has been, take good care of yourselves. Thanks for being part of the conversation. Thanks for engaging. We'll be back in 23 short hours. If it's safe, hug your loved ones and have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.